It is that time of the week where we bring to you yet another exciting episode of Murph and Morgan on the Loose. Oh no, that's a different episode we're going to do. It's called Game of Crimes, episode 133. 133. Yeah.
I'm tickled to death that we're at 133, and I'm looking forward to us hitting 233.
233. Sounds like a bingo game, you know, B5. Anyway, hey guys, welcome back to Game of Crimes. I'm here literally with my partner in crime. I'm Morgan, and you are, who are you again?
Hey everybody, it's Murph.
Murph the Smurf. He's blue because he's sad because he's having to wear long pants today. That's why Murph the Smurf is blue. It's just...
Oh, you don't expect to do that in Florida, you know? It's short. You just put your shorts on, that's where you go.
It's 60 degrees. If it was 60 degrees here, Murph, I'd be in short sleeves and shorts and, you know, some nice shoes and outside. I can't believe you have wussed out to the point of where now it's 60 degrees, you have to have pants on.
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. Y'all say a prayer for me.
Y'all say a prayer. While you're saying a prayer, head on over to Apple and Spotify. Hit those 5 stars. It really helps out a lot. We really appreciate it, guys. And in fact, on Spotify, you can leave comments on each episode. So we encourage you to do that as well. Head on over to our website, GameOfCrimesPodcast.com, for everything. We've got our book list there, our merch. And follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook, and the Instagram. But I'm telling you where you got to be. And we just recorded a fun episode for You Can't Make This Shit Up. And we tried to do some funny stuff, but we did some serious stuff this time. And there was some stuff on there, Murph, you truly could not make up. You just got to listen to the one story. I mean, my one story that still sticks with me is the woman from Mexico who was raped.
And oh, it's outrageous.
Find out what the court said and what they did to her after mm-hmm. she defended herself.
It's outrageous. It just, you know, a lot of the things we talk about, some of that time we're just venting a little bit. You know, we get more into our personal opinions on the Patreon episodes, but we cover some things that we don't cover on here, and it's just outrageous the things that go on.
Well, let me tell you what's outrageous too, and you'll hear us do it a little bit, and I'm just going to plant a stake in the ground here. We had Ken Mead on, retired from Las Vegas Metro PD. Now he's working at Homeland Security. We can announce that. But I was on Twitter or X and listening to all of these, quote, experts talk about they know about the Las Vegas shooting. They know it was a machine gun. They know this. They know that. You guys don't know jack squat. You know, the only person that knows, the person that was there like that, and the only interview he's given was Ken Mead. So for all of you self-professed experts on what happened out in Las Vegas, I encourage you to go listen to the show. And that includes, unfortunately, some people who are throwing their credentials around on Twitter that I'm a military type and I'm a special operator and I know all the stuff. And that was definitely a machine gun. And they know exactly what type of machine gun it was, you know, and they have all the facts wrong. So folks, get your facts straight. Just go listen to episode 131. I can't believe, I'm sorry, Murph, that's my quick rant here again, too. It just ticks me off when I see people like that representing that they know the facts when they actually don't. And then the one person who has the facts, well, yeah, he's just saying that. It's government. It's a conspiracy theory. It's false flag. Tired of hearing that.
You know what? And that's what makes Game of Crime so special. It's not Morgan and Murph going out and talking to people and then coming back and telling you what they said. We bring people in that actually participated, that lived through this. Ken Mead was the lead investigator. I mean, you got hundreds of cops out there doing things. It's all got to come to one person to organize and control this chaos. And that was Ken Mead. Nobody knows more about this case than him. What's the incentive for him to cover up? He's now retired from Vegas PD. If there was a cover up, don't you think he can make a TV series or a book and make a buttload of money? You know, it's just, it's conspiracy theories just gone amok, you know? And it's not just this, it's just about anything that happens in our world now. There's conspiracy theories out there about everything.
It's outrageous. Yeah, last point here, we'll move on. But the people who repeat rumor as fact, well, I know it for a fact. How do you know it for a fact? Do you have access to the case files? Were you there? Did you see? We went through all of that with him on the pictures. Now, it was a bump stock. And how fast the bump stock could cycle and do that made it sound like a machine gun. But there was not a second shooter. Girlfriend was not involved in any way, shape, or form. Right. They still don't know a motive. You know, so, but all of those things got dealt with in episode 131. So last point here, if you're out there thinking that you're a self-proclaimed expert on the Las Vegas shooting, please listen to episode 131 and ye shall be saved. The light will come down and shine upon you and you will have your shit together.
There you go. I mean, it's in depth. It's a 4-part interview. It's almost 4 hours.
And then, yeah. So again, right from the horse, you want it from the horse's mouth. That's the way to do it. Anyway, that's why we do that on Patreon too. We were actually able to go into depth on that, on those cases. We've got a case of the month coming up. 911, what's your emergency? Our narcometer. Murph may almost be out of the doghouse with the narcometer. So it's been a long process of rehabilitation for Murph. Frequent checks, and he's got to wear an ankle bracelet, you know, in case he gets near a bad movie again. It goes off and shocks him. We don't let him touch the button anymore.
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, and our mafia queen has thrown another wrench in this thing. I'm not sure that I'll ever get off probation now.
Well, you will if you get a hold of her. So, yeah, you know, it's Griselda. It's the real investigator from who looked into Griselda Blanco.
That I'm not too worried about.
Yeah.
I think it's
well, if you get that, dude, you're off the hook. Right. But from now on, we have a vetting committee of any movies you submit for review. Have to go through a 3-step process.
Anyway, don't watch Miami Vice. If you haven't watched it, don't waste your time.
Don't watch it. The movie, yeah. So, but that's how do you find all this hilarity? Go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. All of that hilarity is there. Guys, come on over and join us. And also, hey, look, we're just talking about our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato. Just go to facebook.com, type in Game of Crimes fans, close group, just join the fun, join the hilarity, see what's going on. Just answer a couple questions. And we've found guests. We've been incentivized to go find guests. Somebody said, hey, get this person. We go get them. You know, talk about this story. We talk about this story. Stuff that we use for our small town police blotter, You Can't Make This Shit Up. A lot of that stuff comes from you, our loyal listeners, our players in the Game of Crimes fan page. Right, Murph?
Absolutely. And in fact, not the episode we're getting ready to introduce now, but the next two episodes were recommended by listeners here. One was, and we'll give them a shout out, Tracy Jacobs. And I'm not going to name the name of the guest yet. You have to wait and see when they come out. And after that, David Buchalter, who happens to be our agent with UTA Speakers Bureau for Javier and I. So we listen to you guys. You know, you throw us a challenge. We'll see what we can do, just like we're trying to get one of the lead investigators from the Griselda and Blanco investigation after the Griselda series came out on Netflix. So you speak, we listen.
And even in that movie, Sofia Vergara, even with the makeup on, trying to make her look bad, she still looked 5 times better than Griselda did.
Oh my gosh, just go Google the pictures and take a look. You decide for yourself.
Okay. Hey, before we get too far, though, remember, folks, this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take this story seriously, but what, Murph?
We never, never, never take ourselves serious. We have a lot of fun here.
And one of the ways we have fun is we have a little special section we call
Small Town Police Blotter.
Hey, well, now I've got some stories for you here, and they all have a common theme. They all involve masks. So,
masks, okay.
Masks, M-A-S-K-S, masks. So, December 1st, a Michigan man robbed a 7-Eleven store at knife point. Surrendered to police because he was wearing a ski mask, but realized it wasn't going to cut the trick. It wasn't going to do the job, I should say. It wasn't going to cut it. And one of the reasons it wasn't going to cut it, Murph, is that, you know, you go out and you wear a ski mask and stuff. You know, people are going to say, you know, how tall was the guy? What did he look like? Well, this guy, it wouldn't have mattered. The guy they arrested, Damon Matthews, 19, is 7'4". That's why he was in a 7-Eleven. Hey, I must be related. I'm 7'4", you're 7-Eleven, you know?
That's a memorable robbery right there.
Yeah, so according to cops, Matthew told his sister he had robbed the 7-Eleven, a mission that prompted her to advise him to surrender. And she concluded that her brother's connection to the robbery would be obvious to his height. This says, folks, doesn't matter race, doesn't matter anything. How many people do you know that are 7'4"? Call the police with their name. That narrows the list of suspects.
Yeah, it do.
And wow. But what? His robbery charge came 4 days after he pleaded guilty to a larceny charge. So this happened in the little town of Bay City, Michigan, population 32,461. Salute. So he'd originally been charged with home invasion, but that effort was dropped as part of a plea deal, and now he's in jail on a $75,000 charge of armed robbery and felonious misuse of a mask. You know, if you can't. It's like if you weigh 800 pounds and you go in there. What did the guy look like? Or like robbing a bank dressed like a clown, which we had people. He was dressed like a clown. Okay, that's enough.
You know, I mean, so people like that, we say, go find another occupation because you're not going to do real well as being a criminal.
Being stupid is going to hurt, folks. So, now, Murph, in Louisiana, in a little town called Sulphur, Louisiana, population 21,809.
Salute.
It's about 20 miles east of the Texas border. They responded to a call about a suspicious man prowling around homes and peering into windows. When they did, they saw a suspect run away. He ignored police demands to stop. They found him hiding beneath a mattress, and beneath that mattress, he was wearing a black gorilla suit at the time, thinking that would disguise him.
Yeah, because, you know, when you lift your mattress up, you expect to see a gorilla laying under there, right?
And this is going to explain it all. He was charged with multiple offenses, including unauthorized entry of an inhabited dwelling, resisting a police officer with violence or force, wearing a mask or hood in public, and possession of meth.
There you go. What do we say?
Don't do meth. All right. Wow. So they asked the police, why do you think he was in the gorilla suit? And they said, the only reason we could figure out was he was on dope. He was on drugs. That's what they said. They said, ask about it. A police spokesman said the only reason Moran would have opted for the costume was the possibility of the drugs he was using.
Explains it all.
All right. Now, Murph, who's one of the smartest people in history?
Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson.
Think a theory of relativity, speed of light.
I don't know. I don't know.
Albert Einstein. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
Okay. Oh, you can tell this is not going to go well for Murph. Okay, Rockets. You're no Albert Einstein.
I told you we don't take ourselves serious here.
That's right. Well, you're no Albert Einstein, and neither was this guy. So a suspect, still undetermined, robbed a Wells Fargo, which I'm fine with robbing Wells Fargo. I think I've told you my Wells Fargo story. So F Wells Fargo. So population 25,463. Salute. They're in Venice, Florida, right? He left with an undisclosed amount of money and maced a customer who sought to follow him from the bank. He was wearing an Albert Einstein mask. So the deputies are seeking the public's help in identifying the man who posed as the German physicist during the post-Halloween heist. He was last fleeing in a red sedan driven by an accomplice.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't even know what to say to that. Stupid.
You couldn't get speed of light. Come on, Albert Einstein. Dude, I'm telling you, Florida has made you soft. Living in Florida has made you soft.
The next thing you know, I'll be doing meth. Look out.
All right. As they say, all right. Okay, let's get into this episode, because the nice thing about it is we spent a lot of time with this guest introducing him the first time, so there's no need to introduce him a lot. Just right. Our buddy Zach, if you can spell his last name and say it correctly three times in a row, you win a prize, as yet to be determined. But this is interesting, Murph, because, you know, we've been staying in touch with him and some things have been happening, but very interesting because this, if you would have told me, put into one case, DEA, Hamas, and Mossad, I would have said, I'm in. Damn, I'm in.
Oh, yeah. It was not Hamas, but Hezbollah.
I mean, Hezbollah, yeah. Well, that too. There's probably some Hamas people involved in it. As you'll find out at the beginning of the episode, we're having a little conversation. They didn't know I was recording, but how do you do a hillbilly twang with Hamas? Is it Hamas?
Now, Zach is, you know, this case started when I was still in special operations, but it was down in our, not secret sections, but we had a couple of enforcement groups down there, the 959 and 960 groups. And then it continued to grow. So as Zach is telling us about this in this interview, this is the first in-depth I've ever heard about this case. And I was shocked, but I shouldn't be, because I know DEA has long tentacles and will try things that other agencies want. But the fact that they were working with Mossad, you know, and I think that's one of the leading intelligence groups in the entire world. I was just real proud to hear what's going on, and you're going to be, I think you're really going to enjoy this interview with Rob.
And I learned something too. I learned the difference between a project and an operation, because I called it Operation Cassandra and it was actually Project Cassandra. So we get into finding what's the difference between the two. But there's only one way we're going to find out about this, Murph. And I have to ask you, are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous and hillbilly friendly game of all, the Game of Crimes?
Absolutely, y'all. Now get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. We're going to find out about... Sorry, I can't do this with a straight face. We're going to find out about Project Cassandra.
Jens Hezbollah?
Oh no, that's Pennsylvania. We don't say Jens.
Jens is straight Pittsburgh, huh? I thought it might be close enough to Morgantown.
Nah, we're still y'all.
Jens guys.
Well, see, I started recording because we were having too much fun. So you guys caught in on the first part of that. We're trying to decide if Iranian and terrorist names sound better in a West Virginia twang, like Abu Dhabi and
Dang Tootin, that Hezbollah, that group out there. You got to watch it.
Hamas. Boy. Is Hamas like hummus? What is that? What is that stuff there?
That's fantastic.
That's a nickname we use, Hamas.
Hamas, yeah. Well, you guys may not recognize the voice, but you certainly recognize the inability of everybody to pronounce his last name correctly. We just call him Zach. And what does Zach call himself?
Zach. Zach's fine.
And your real name? Tell
no, more guys. Name. Rob Zaharyashevitz.
See, and it rhymes with Manischewitz, so Zaharyashevitz. So that's the only way I can remember, because I thought it was Zaharyashevsky, but no, it's not that.
Common spelling.
Common spelling.
Yeah. Somebody that we've had on here, I think, more than once.
Yeah, we actually did a Patreon episode with him. We did a follow-up on his case on Guess What? You know what? Let's do that real quick, because guess what? Shocker of shockers. After Victor Boot was traded for Brittany Griner, then the head of the Wagner Group, you know, who knew wine bottles exploded at 30,000 feet? I thought pressurized cabin would keep those things from just blowing up, but apparently they blew up.
Well, there you go.
Blew him out of the air.
Yeah, and, you know, I have some pretty reliable sources that told me that Victor was actually supposed to be on that plane and was warned off in some way, shape, or form.
No kidding.
Yeah, can't promise you that's right, but I can tell you it's well-placed.
It sounds believable, too.
Well, your conspiracy theories are far more credible than some of the other ones I've heard.
Yeah, I think I warned you guys a while ago, Saab would get traded for Fat Leonard, so, and... Alex Dobbs back in Venezuela.
Well, and here's it. Let's kind of close out on that loop real quick, though. But the interesting part is, has Victor Boot come back in and got a leadership position in Wagner Group, or is he going to take that over?
I haven't. I can tell you that he's been very public. I look at him much more these days as kind of a spokesman, or as I like to call him, the chief propaganda officer. He's certainly made some public pronouncements about the arms trade and Africa's right to arm. Kind of sounds like, you know, yesteryear. But I can't tell you. I couldn't tell you what his formal role in that area is.
Well, as we're catching up with Zach, look, if you want to go back and listen to the episode we had with Zach. And Murph's going to tell me the episode number here in a minute.
Number 19.
So listen to that, because a lot of Rob's history and background is in that. We're not going to do that over again. But, you know, what we covered was Operation Relentless, basically the DEA operation to get Victor Boot. When everybody else said, hey, you know, he's tough to get, DEA goes, hold my beer. And then Victor Boot is in custody, which, by the way, here's the thing I'm still laughing about. Well, I think it was you guys were in, you were in Romania?
Yes, sir.
Staged up? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
And what movie were you watching? The Lord of War with Nicolas Cage as Yuri Orlov, you know, imitating Victor Boot. I can't believe you guys were watching that.
Well, we watched it, and the best part is we watched it with Romanian subtitles, so it kind of brought the whole flavor home.
Oh, man. Well, but you know what? But again, you know, fact is stranger than fiction. All of those things that we talked about, guess what? Victor Boot now is walking around as a free man.
Yep. In fact, we brought Zach back here on December 26th when we took a Christmas break, and we had him on one of our Patreon issues to give us an update, and that was after they had traded Victor for Griner. So this is third time on the show. You're the first person we've had on here three times.
You're a three time. We've two time people, but we've never three time people. So
three-peat.
I'm not sure if I'm honored or I'm worried about you boys. Times might be getting a little tough.
Yeah, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel, man. Nobody wants to come on the podcast anymore.
No. Trust me, there's always Derek Maltz. He's always good for great shows, man. I love it. That
pretty soon you're going to have me on to be talking about like what home projects I'm working on. Or
it'll be like an episode of NPR. So, Zach, what are we working on today?
Yeah, that's good stuff. But this is what we're going to talk about today is a story that you told us about previously that just really piqued our curiosity. We put it on the list. We know you got a million things going and we hate to keep bothering you, but it just
got to
the point where I'm trying to be nice here. You know, we might want to bring you back a fourth and fifth time. You never know. But this one is just beyond belief. I really knew nothing about this case in DEA. So I'm really excited to find out about all the details. And I've got my laptop up here with a Word document so I can record these names because these are names I'm not familiar with anymore. So, welcome back, Zach. Nah,
it's a pleasure to be back.
And for me, just trying to pronounce all these. It's going to be like George Bush, you know, when Will Ferrell did that imitation of him on Saturday Night Live after the debate, you know, doing all the imitation of all the world leaders. Well, there's, you know, I can't remember all the names he was doing, but it was in that Texas twang, you know?
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Well, the sad thing is I understood everything he said.
No, man, getting back and talking to you guys is just like getting together with two old friends. So I'm happy to be here with you. It's good to see you.
Thank you, brother. Thank you.
They see I'm actually looking at you because we're online here. But luckily, your audience doesn't have to look at these three ugly mugs on camera together. So
we all have faces for radio.
I don't know about you, but me, I got to go get a haircut Thursday. I don't know if you guys can see this. It's just like really long. So I got to go.
Damn hippie.
Yeah, exactly.
You see him rubbing that in, right, Zach?
A little bit.
You know, hair is singular and plural. So when I say I have to get a haircut, I mean plural, not singular. Murph. Like I got one hair here.
Yeah, but it doesn't take me a long time to go to a barbershop now.
Oh, and Zach, you're going to love this too. We had Boyd Holbrook on to start off the year.
We were doing
this interview with Boyd, and we're out talking about Boyd. But what were you doing to, you know, like imitate Murph? He hung out with him. He says, well, what I did, he did the entire both seasons so he could look like Murph. He took a razor and he shaved a receding hairline into his head every single day.
Yeah, see, that's just hurtful, to be honest with you. Even retell that story is just a little mean-spirited, I think.
Yeah, I tell you what, man, I drove down this past weekend to Miami to do some filming on another project. And I actually pulled up Boyd's interview on Game of Crimes and listened to both episodes. And we got to that point, and I'm just shaking my head down the road. And people are looking at me like, what's wrong with that guy?
Well, you'll appreciate this too, Zach. We were talking about, hey, we've all got something in common on this podcast. One is, you know, obviously, you know, Narcos, you know, I've got Steve and Javi on here, you know, and you were in it. I said, number two, we've all received training by DEA. He goes, yeah. I said, and I was leading him down the path. I said, number three, we've all been told, don't go in the house. No.
Yeah, that was kind of painful to listen to him relive that.
No, it's like you might as well just tell the Murph, like, it was the toughest role of my life. I had to ugly myself up every day just to get in character.
Hey, you should see him now, Zach. He's preparing for a film where he's going to be a prisoner, you know, a convicted murderer on a hunger strike in a prison.
Wow.
He's lost 37 pounds. He looks like – he sent us a picture. He looks like skin and bones.
Hell, I sent him a care package. I said, you know, dude, just to eat something, you know. But, yeah, he did. Yeah. He dropped the weight. He looks so – you know. And the sad part was is that when we had him on, the actor strike, you know, started, and then it wasn't completely over yet. There were some exclusions for independent films. But – so he started losing all of this weight, and then it was like it was put on hold. Well, he didn't want to put it on and take it off again, so he was maintaining weight. And you know what that reminded me of, guys?
What's that?
It reminded me I had to go get a – you're gonna think, how is this even relevant? I had to go get a colonoscopy, and I was all done through the whole prep thing for 2 days, you know, 4 days. And on day three and a half, they call me. They say, oh, our power's out. We have to reschedule you. I said, no, I'm not doing this again. So I had to start it all over again like a half a day later. So 8 days of that. So I feel for me and Boyd, we got, you know, we're bonding. We got something in common.
I appreciate you, Morgan, because now anybody that listens is going to refer to me having been on the colonoscopy episode. That's going to be my new claim to fame.
Hey, let me tell you, those folks who've been out there, and you know, if you're over 50, everybody needs to go get one.
There's your public service announcement of the day.
There's your PSA from
you. You know what Morgan did when they called him and told him the power's out? He said, give me the tube. I'll shove it up there myself.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not going through this again. I don't care if the power's out. Just
exactly. Anyway. Now Morgan's like hooked. He goes to the doctor like, Morgan, we just gave you one last month. We're not doing it again. Stop asking.
Please, please. Come on, please. Just one more. And,
And as you can tell, Zach's my dealer, man. If I need to go get some pale pectate and some other stuff, I hit up my man, Zach. Zach,
it's all about connections.
Come on, Zach. Man, don't do this to me like this.
We're going way down a freaking rabbit hole here, man.
Not sure. This is not the pitch you gave me.
Sorry, man.
Bait and switch. Are you not familiar with Hollywood? Bait and switch.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like I need a self-help clinic.
Well, let's kind of rewind real quick. Hey, but as we get started, we don't want folks to go back and we don't want to repeat everything we talked about, but just give everybody real quick, just a 2-minute overview, you know, of how you got into DEA, you know, and then lead us up into this operation here, Operation Cassandra.
Yeah. Well, look, I try not to miss an opportunity to give a shout out to my Uncle Bobby. My godfather, Bobby Grant, career DEA agent, he was my father's roommate at Fordham, greatest guy going. And he's a hero to me growing up, so that's all I ever really wanted to do. So in 1998, I became an agent. I spent 5 years in New York learning the ropes from what DEA affectionately calls the New York Mafia, a place where you learn how to do a little bit of everything. And then I was lucky enough in 2003, I was selected to a elite unit in DEA Special Operations Division called the Bilateral Investigations Unit. So very briefly, I'll just explain that the BIU was DEA's response to 9/11. It was built up in the shadow, in the ashes of the World Trade Center. And the idea initially was to go touch the untouchable. It was a kingpin unit. But we quickly, with a string of early successes, we evolved into narco-terrorism and very, very high-level political corruption. So with that, you know, that's kind of the lead into why DEA would be engaged in these type of cases. With building the BIU, they also built the CINTOC, the Counter-Narcotics Terrorism Operations Center and Special Operations. So hand in hand, those two units were pretty well equipped to kind of go after anybody and everybody. The CINTOC was more, it was on the intelligence side. Its job was to liaise and coordinate with all the other three-letter acronyms, three-letter agencies in the USG and even foreign. DEA Special Ops is an awesome place. There's representatives from, you know, every agency you can think of, including many foreign ones. I think we have Aussie counterparts and British counterparts, and there's even an NYPD rep. So, you know, with that, that's kind of how our targeting worked. We had an unbelievable stable of informants providing us stuff, and we had a lot of support from the broader community where we would get leads and corroborate our tips and kind of decide who's who in the zoo and who needed to come off the playing field.
You know, and as you're doing this too, the other thing we want to kind of set the stage for too is we're going to be talking about some terrorist groups, Hezbollah primarily, but, you know, we kind of set the stage too by realizing that after the revolution, it was stated that Hezbollah was Iran's most successful export. You know, Iran is the primary proxy. I mean, Hezbollah and Hamas are proxies for Iran, and they support them along with the Houthi rebels. So you guys are seeing that play out now in Israel and the attacks going on in the Red Sea and everything else. So what Zach's talking about, you know, these things have long tentacles. This isn't just something that, you know, popped up one day. Iran has been involved in this since basically the day of the revolution, and Hezbollah gets a lot of support and a lot of training and funding from Iran.
If you can, Zach, just briefly describe for our listeners what the authority is that allows DEA to go after these foreigners like this.
So there's two main laws that that we used. Originally, our group was called the 959 Group. There's a law, 21 United States Code, Section 959, which is basically part of our drug laws. And in a nutshell, it said more or less, if you're trafficking in drugs in narcotics anywhere in the world with the knowledge or intent that some portion of that is ultimately going to the United States, you can be tried in a U.S. court of law. And it got a little funky because the way it's written, it's either in Washington, D.C. or where you first land in the country. The reason being there's no act in the United States to give venue. So we worked with Southern District in New York, and we were constantly having to they don't have an international airport there, believe it or not. You know, John F. Kennedy's in the Eastern District of New York. LaGuardia is the Eastern District of New York. So we had to really rough it and get private planes, chartered flights into Westchester. And
my heart bleeds for you.
Yeah, it was tough.
Appreciate that sacrifice.
Well, somehow we muddled through, Murph. And then in 2006, I believe it was Congressman Hyde sponsored a bill, the narco-terrorism statute, which is 21 USC 960A, which very, very similar. It basically says if you are trafficking narcotics and giving pecuniary, you know, financial support to a State Department listed terrorist organization or a group that acts like a terrorist organization, they didn't actually have to be listed. Same deal. You can be tried in a U.S. court of law. The only difference between the two laws, they're very draconian. 959 was a 10-year minimum mandatory sentence, and 960A was actually a 20-year minimum mandatory sentence. So massive sword to hold over someone's head when you got them on it. You know, quick side note. I know, you know, you always like the irony, Murph. At one point, I proposed trying to prosecute a Mexican cartel under 960A, with the basic theory being, you know, at that time, I don't know if you remember the news reports, at that time, there was an incident down in Mexico where one of the cartels had cut off the heads of some of its victims and literally rolled them across the dance floor in a disco. With people there, I mean. And so my thought was, you know, you're chopping off heads, rolling them across the dance floor. It seems to me you're acting like a terrorist organization. You know, you should be eligible. And I got told that the State Department would never tolerate that we couldn't do anything, that anything that using the word terrorism in Mexico would hurt tourism. So therefore, we were not allowed to go after the cartels that way.
You know, and see that you bring up something too, Zach. The State Department is the entity ultimately responsible for designating specially designated nationals, foreign terrorist organizations, and Hezbollah is a designated terrorist organization. Back even since 1997, it's been adjudicated that way by many countries. But you bring up a really interesting point. For years, I know, and they've tried to just reintroduce it into Congress recently. It was called the Narcos Act. I think Lindsey Graham may have done it, but some other folks. But, you know, what you're talking about, Sinaloa acts just like a terrorist group. What's the difference between Sinaloa and, you know, Al-Qaeda or ISIS? They're involved in the same things. They're doing the same things. They're committing and in fact, you know, people go, oh, look at the terrorists just beheaded somebody. How many people are beheaded by Sinaloa or, you know, Jalisco New Generation, you know, or all the other people down there in Mexico? There is very little difference between a Mexican cartel and a foreign terrorist organization.
Well, look at you know, the cocaine trade. The FARC became the biggest cocaine suppliers in Colombia, mm-hmm. and they were supplying all the Mexican cartels directly. I mean, they're literally meeting, cutting deals for 5,000, 10,000 kilos at a time, partnerships of some form, and FARC's a terrorist organization and the others aren't. And, you know, when we get into it, the funny thing, what I find really ironic is when it comes to the drug trade, all the groups that get involved, it seems like they go through the exact same evolution. And I think when we start touching on Hezbollah, I think you're going to see that a little bit too. They start possibly with some cause, maybe it's misguided, but a cause of some sort, whether it's political or religious, and they're looking for a way to fight that cause and to fund their fight. Usually those groups are, you know, fairly heavily armed and control some territory that may hold some value. And often the value it holds is through transportation routes, whether it's legitimate goods or black market goods. So you take the drug trade, these groups will have some control over a territory that drug traffickers need to operate in, so they start to tax them. And after a while, the money's so good and they really start to see how these drug traffickers are operating to be able to properly tax them. And they say, well, wait a minute, there's a lot of money to be made there. Why are we just taxing them? We're just going to take over the trade in our area. And that's exactly what the FARC did. Originally, they just taxed the cocaleros, the cocaine growers. And, you know, every kilo you put out, you got to give us X dollars. And they looked at the money and they said, new rules. We own everything and we will pay you by the kilo that you actually delivered to us. By the way, here's what you're allowed to charge us. And they ultimately become, you know, the big traffickers. Well, I think you could see the exact same evolution, in my opinion, with Hezbollah. They're into a lot of vices. There's a massive Lebanese diaspora throughout the world from all the years of war in Lebanon. And most of their folks end up, you know, very, very industrious businessmen, and they end up in all the tax-free zones throughout the world, where all the money laundering seems to hit pipelines. And as a result, you know, they ended up in the money laundering game. So with folks all over the world, you know, if you look at all the traditional groups that have become the top money launderers, originally bankers, you know, those are the folks that have basically family ties all over the world and can operate in a hawala type network where they have to, where it's all just on trust. And from there, once you're laundering everybody's money, you end up, you know, with the ends to get into the actual trade that these the nefarious folks are involved in.
You know, and let's put a point on this though, too, because these terrorist groups are committing the types of crimes that if a regular individual committed in the same country, they'd face a death penalty for under Islamic law. You know, so it's kind of an irony when you look at, like, with the Taliban, the amount of heroin, you know, and the opium poppies that they were producing, you know, and harvesting. So it's, again, it's one of those, you know, fact is stranger than fiction.
Well, so, it supports the concept that we all know is true. Money speaks louder than words. You know, do as I say.
Yeah. All laws become pretty malleable when there's a profit to be made, right, Murph?
Oh, absolutely.
And when the outcome is to arm, you know, is to, like you say, we were saying, Zach, earlier, these folks are heavily armed. That doesn't come cheap. You know, that comes through people like Victor Boot or other stuff. You got to buy these things, and that takes money. And one of the easiest ways to generate money is through what? The illicit drug trade.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what you'll see with Hezbollah, especially when we talk about it, is, you know, it's not like that was the only vice they were in. That was just a natural offshoot. Black market oil, chemicals, arms. I mean, anything really where you can make a buck, right? And I think when you really, really saw the spread into a lot of these vices, and not just initially money laundering, but really getting into all these trades, is when, you know, I think at one point our sanctions were working to some degree, and a lot of funding dried up from Iran, and you know, Hezbollah had to find other ways to be able to support itself, because they were financially being hurt. So they became much more self-sufficient. How do you do that? You get into the black market trade.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things after living in Loudoun County, one of the things, if you go back to Zach's episode, is we found out where you were on 9/11, which was right there in New York. I was in Loudoun County, you know, I was in DC that day, and saw the Pentagon, you know, saw those things. But what happened afterwards, I think, kind of is the genesis for some of this. But they started realizing there were a lot of, quote, Islamic relief organizations that were nothing but funneling money back over to Hamas, Hezbollah. In fact, one of the largest terrorism financing cases still in the United States today, it's called the Holy Land Foundation. It was a case, I think, from 2005. And all of that information is out there. They've got all these unindicted co-conspirators, but it's huge, the number of people that are involved in this and the amount of money. And then when I was doing my work down at Justice on information sharing, I learned from the ATF that one of the ways that they were raising money in the United States too was through cigarette tax stamp counterfeiting. They would get a pack of cigarettes without the tax stamp on it. They'd put the tax stamp on it, and they'd collect, because the amount of tax on a pack of cigarettes was pretty significant. And then that was hard currency they could send back. So, like, to your point, they were finding any way they could to finance it. So we're kind of setting the stage here. So financing, you know, again, that's one of the three legs of the stool, right? You have to have time, anonymity, support if you want to do terrorist operations. But the thing that runs this, right? Money is the oil that, you know, lubricates the gears that makes this whole thing work. Without it, they're nothing but a group of, you know, people sitting in the desert somewhere with nowhere to go.
Well, and the next evolution is crypto, right? Now, that's what you're seeing now. They've, you know, they constantly evolve. They're survivors. They need to continue their operations in their mind. So Now, I think that that's what you're seeing, and a lot of that's coming out about Hamas and how they're able to fund themselves, especially through the help of good friends like Qatar. But you see all these guys have been involved in crypto, and you see a lot of the same charitable fundraising. You basically see a lot of small individual wallets that are collecting funds, but if you're able to blockchain those out and track them, they all pipe into one big central charity.
And then, we say charitable organizations with air quotes around them.
Yeah, and look, the sad part there's a lot of worthy cause out there and people that need it gets commingled. So how do you, I think that's the challenge for a lot of folks trying to enforce this is how do you target a charity and kind of separate out the good from the bad? It's like human shields, right? Is it really that different? It's human shields from a metaphysical standpoint, but how do you, you hold the charity up in front of yourself and say, good for you. You know what? You take the world's hunger basket. Mm-hmm. And take that away and see how your stance in the world is. So those are the challenges that we face.
Well, yep. It's just like what they're doing right over now in Gaza. I mean, a lot of relief agencies are delivering supplies, but guess who's taking them all?
Yeah.
It goes right back to Hamas, So let's set the stage for this. So this is called Operation Cassandra. It's something we touched on a little bit before. But I mean, this involves a lot of things too. I'll throw it out there, and then you help connect the dots together. I mean, a lot of this involves Iran, even some tangents over to Venezuela. It involves intelligence agencies. But the interesting thing, I pulled up the DEA press release. Basically, when they talked about this, there's one country missing from this that I'm shocked about.
What
country do you think is missing from the press release that was involved in this?
Iran.
No, but in terms of a cooperating country, one that was involved, there's no mention of the word Israel in this.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they talk about, I just pulled it up. They talked about Project Cassandra. They talk about all the people who were involved, but I just did a keyword search for Israel. And I went through a couple things. Nothing. They talk about DEA Philadelphia, DEA offices in Europe, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, FinCEN, Treasury Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, Treasury Office of Foreign Assets Control, which is OFAC, Europol, and Eurojust, but no mention of Israel.
Yeah, well, I was mentioning before, a good friend, Udi Levy, who's a proud Israeli war horse and is one of the primary characters in a book we were discussing before. It's called Harpoon, which was the Israeli operation targeting terror funding. And they kind of do the opposite. They gave some very nice praise to Cassandra and to the support of the U.S. I think part of that might be, I think the relationship, if you read along with that book and buy into the theories, I think the relationship was a little more informal with Israel, and it's because they didn't get too far with a lot of other agencies, and they hit it off pretty well with DEA and really bought into what we were doing. And with guys like Udi, they decided that the way to cripple these networks was to take away their funding. And I think in many instances, we've seen that proven right. It's hard to constantly be taking their arms away, but if they can't buy them in the first place, then, it gets a little different. So,
yeah, because anytime you mention Hezbollah,
it certainly gives a good layout.
Yeah, because I was going to say, anytime you mention Hezbollah, there has to be a touch point with Israel somewhere, Mossad, even internally, Shin Bet, folks like that. They're dealing with these folks every single day. Israel's the main target for a lot of these terrorist organizations in the Middle East. But let's get into Cassandra. So, let's talk about what the purpose of Cassandra was and how it came into being.
Not to bore with too many details, but you mentioned Operation Cassandra. It was actually Project Cassandra, not sound like a big deal, but just for structurally, DEA has cases, operations, then ultimately at times projects. And so the way it works is Special Operations Division creates quote-unquote operations, gives operation names, which are blankets to connect all the related cases in the world. So you could have a group in New York and a group in Miami, and they're both working a case with a source organization in Colombia, and they have no idea that they're targeting the same folks downrange, that the same folks downrange are ultimately supplying each of their domestic groups. And that was one of the jobs of Special Operations Division. They would coordinate all these cases, get all the agents together, kind of unify all the intelligence coming in, and you know, and you know, create much stronger operations in that way. And so there are times when these operations are actually crossing over into other operations. You have a Mexico-focused operation and a Colombia-focused operation. Don't even realize, you know, that there's massive tentacles to each. And that a lot of the same people are getting targeted, but the selectors aren't hitting, meaning, well, let's say one operation is very focused on telecommunications. And so it's coordinating all the phones that are hitting in the world. But another operation is focused on undercover money pickups and some banking, or just straight human intelligence, and coordinating all the human intelligence. And so maybe for a while, you know, they're not crossing over because they're drawing from two different types of intelligence. And then next thing you know, people connect the dots and say, holy cow, all these operations are the same. Then you create a project to coordinate it all. Well, that's what you saw in Cassandra. You had all these different instances where, let's not even say Hezbollah, let's just say Lebanese trafficking networks were appearing. And I point that out on purpose. That became one of the big fights, internal fights with DEA under Cassandra, was where do you draw the line between some Lebanese drug traffickers and Hezbollah-affiliated drug trafficking groups? You know, there are times, so I'll give the example of the north coast of Colombia. As Murph could tell you from his time down there, it's still Wild West. There's a semi-autonomous region that is still largely controlled by indigenous populations down there in Colombia on the north coast area between, say, Santa Marta, Colombia, which is all in the Caribbean, and Venezuela. And there's a ton of drug trafficking out there, very, you know, very adept money laundering networks and maritime Colombian trading organizations. There's also a huge, that's probably the largest Lebanese diaspora, Lebanese-Syrian diaspora in Colombia, is on that North Coast region. You'll see a lot of names that sound very Middle Eastern. You'll have a lot of groups that are, you know, Middle Eastern bloodlines. So does that in and of itself make them eligible to be run under a Hezbollah operation? Well, no. I mean, there's a lot of groups there that are just traditional Colombian trafficking families that happen to have Lebanese bloodlines. And before, you know, before we get into when we see really getting involved, one interesting crossover from the last time or the first time I was with you guys is talking about Victor Boot. The last Israeli Hezbollah war, major one, I believe, was 2006. And there was a report in The Guardian that came out after the war, during the war, that in the opening days, in the opening salvos, Victor Boot was spotted in Beirut, and the Mossad or Israel tried to take him out. They dropped a hotel trying to take him out.
Wow.
And so, you know,
anything worth doing is worth overdoing.
To everything. What's that?
I said anything worth doing is worth overdoing. You want to take out a guy, just take out the whole damn building.
And look, I can't promise you that story's good. I mean, I think it's a pretty respectable.
It doesn't matter. Sounds good, though. It sounds good. Yeah. It sounds legit, too, over there. Yeah.
And listen, when we first started targeting Victor Boot, it came from a FARC case. I think we talked about that last time. It came from a FARC case in Colombia. The Colombian authorities, we had a manhunt for a guy we were looking for in Colombia that they called Boyaco, and who ironically was working for a FARC commander that was holding CIA contractors as hostage. And the Colombians told us, you know, Boyaco was trying to do a surface-to-air missile deal for the FARC with some guy named Ali Hijazi out of Venezuela, who was working using Victor Boot Airlines out of Aruba. Well, Ali Hijazi was Muammar Gaddafi's intelligence agent, reported, as best I can tell, pretty directly to Muammar, but he's a Libyan intelligence agent that Victor ran around with that had strong ties to Hezbollah. So
was he also,
it all works together.
Was he also tied in with some of the guys on Lockerbie, Pan Am 103?
That I can't – I've never seen anything to that effect. He was a ghost for me for a long time, and then finally some reports came out. He's a big aviation guy. But, you know, in the Boot trial, we actually had evidence on Boot's laptop that he had somewhat recently done a, meaning in the last year or two, a some type of a communications deal to Libya, high-grade military communications equipment. The Honorable Shira Shindlin decided that that evidence was prejudicial and should be suppressed. Kind of ironic being there was somewhat of an entrapment defense. It seemed that that would be perfect evidence to defeat that type of defense, showing, no, you're actually engaged in that trade. But
so overwhelming evidence is prejudicial to the defense.
Yeah.
Huh. Something
I was unaware of.
Every defense attorney in the world will claim
there's
that.
There's a reason that judge was a laughingstock in the Southern District. I'll leave it alone at that. God bless her.
Should have been over in the Ninth Circus.
There you go.
That's an inside joke for you folks listening. The Ninth Circuit out of California is affectionately referred to as the Ninth Circus because I think they have the highest rate of their rulings being overturned of any district.
They come up some crazy stuff out there, that's for sure.
Well, back to our regularly scheduled podcast with Zach. So
there we go. way to rip it back in, Morgan. Good job.
Yeah, well, that's that. You talk about a rabbit hole. That would be a rabbit hole.
Yeah, we could spend all day there. So, but it's as you're laying this out, though, too. That's very interesting because a lot of the Hezbollah, members are Lebanese, but not every Lebanese is a member of Hezbollah. I mean, it's kind of a logical contradiction or logical issue people kind of conflate. Well, just because you're one doesn't mean you're the other. But most of this other group tends to be, Lebanese. But how did you guys work that? Thanks for the clarification too, because I think sometimes unless you're doing the inside baseball, everybody thinks it's an operation. But to understand what the project means, that gives it a lot more clarity in terms of what the scope of this problem was.
Well, yeah. So the best way I can describe it is in the latter half of the 2000s. So let's just say somewhere around 2007, 2008, we started really seeing more and more bits of intelligence. I won't even call it initially that Hezbollah or any other group was involved in drug trafficking. There was just some really weird blips showing up on the radars, right? So basically, we were – so the best example I can give is there's calls started coming across the Salas. The Sala is a listening post in Colombia. Or in this example, in Colombia. So basically, DEA and a lot of our really strong counterpart nations that fight the good fight with us, Colombia being the best example, we would help provide infrastructure, create infrastructure for them to carry on the narco wars.
What was the name of that listening post again?
What'd you call it? Sala.
How's that spelled?
S-A-L-A, right, Murph?
Yeah.
S-A-L-A?
Oh, okay. It's Spanish for room.
It's what we would call a wire room here in the States.
Okay.
There's some, in many instances, and, there was a huge funding mechanism in Colombia to fight the drug war called Plan Colombia that's been written about over and over. And a lot of that money went to helping build these guys' infrastructure. And so we had vetted units in Colombia, which means that we would actually polygraph them. Very trusted units. We help fund them. We might give them a stipend to their pay, try to keep them on the right side of things, because obviously in countries like that, one of the goals of the cartel is to corrupt everyone and get them on their own payroll. And so we had, and I think from his time down there, Murph, I think we'll back this up. Look, there's corruption in these countries, but there's some unbelievable warriors that just
absolutely
some of my favorite partners, for lack of a better word, that I ever worked with were foreign counterparts. If you ask me the top 10 cops I ever worked with, I can tell you flat out one of the first ones that comes to mind was a vetted member out of Suriname, of all places. We had, those are the guys I still consider brothers. And so at any rate, we have these listening posts, these salas, and in a lot of countries like Colombia, there's actually units that DEA would help run. I mean, we would help guide them and would be providing intelligence. Hey, these are numbers to target. These are groups to target. Here's what we're seeing. What are you seeing? And come up with joint targeting. And they would get judicial intercepts up that we could actually use in a U.S. court of law. They would be used down in Colombia, but we could actually use them in a U.S. court of law. And so we have these phones up. There's a phenomenal group, Group 10 in Miami, tremendous agents who initiated Operation Titan. What we'll talk about in a minute, and that'll help explain the difference between operation and project. But what starts happening is they start getting these calls in Colombia, And they would send the calls up north to us and say, hey, man, there's these calls. We have no idea what these are. You're speaking gibberish. We don't understand what it is. You know, in one instance, this group in Miami, Group 10, and I'm probably messing the story up a little, but
nobody's ever heard it before, Zach. We don't know. You could mess it up. You could say Abu Nidal was in charge of everything. Hell, we wouldn't know.
And I'll just stick to first names here, but phenomenal agent Sharon down there, tremendous. She's helping run this case. And this really is kind of the genesis of what we'll talk about in some of Cassandra. The agents send up the calls from Colombia and say, we have no idea what this is. And they're listening to the calls, and there's a young Lebanese-speaking agent in the group, former U.S., proud U.S. Marine, Rick, phenomenal agent. And he hears them debating these calls, and he's like, well, you know, those are Arabic. They're speaking in Arabic. Like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, I speak Arabic. My family's Lebanese. I grew up in Lebanon. They're speaking Arabic. Really? And that's where that's one of the points of genesis where we started realizing there was something weird going on. And when they translated the calls, they're drug calls. There's you know, organizations moving, speaking Arabic, moving drugs to the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. And that was part of that ended up right flat in the middle of Operation Titan. Now, Miami Group 10 was a phenomenal money laundering group that just did some unbelievable money launder cases. There's things called, I don't think we talked about this before, but they're called AGEOs, Attorney General Exempted Operations, which is basically a license to break U.S. law. It's called Attorney General because it's got to be approved all the way up to the Attorney General's office. There's a lot of really tight guidelines. Very late in my career, I get to help oversee some of these programs. And essentially, it's a blessing for DEA to go out and be able to launder money. And so the reason we do that is it's very hard to let even the smallest of drug shipments go through. It used to be very hard. It's now 100% impossible because of fentanyl. So let's say it's a 10-gram. You want to let just do a 10-gram sample go through so that in an undercover operation so that the drug trafficker thinks that the undercover is actually a righteous bad guy. So how would you do that? Well, you want to let a little bit of the drugs go through. If immediately he says, well, no, I don't want to actually traffic. It's like, well, what's wrong with you? I thought you were here to be a drug trafficker. Or if he, you know, if people immediately get arrested, you don't get to climb up the ladder. And so allowing drugs to go through is basically, you know, like no dice. Exactly. However, under tight guidelines, we could let money go through. And so there's instances where DEA would pose as money launderers and literally receiving, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not even as much as $1 million at a time, and letting a portion go through so that the bad guys would say, well, they can't possibly be cops because they actually moved our money and we got it. But you do that to uncover the network, to find the phones you want to listen to find out, you know, again, who's who in the zoo. And that's what Titan, you know, that's a lot of what Titan was built on. And next thing you know, they find themselves flat in the middle of a Lebanese Hezbollah affiliated money laundering network. One of the big bosses that gets ID'd was Ayman Juma. I think he ultimately became a CPOT, Consolidated Priority Operational Target. Basically, a CPOT's a designation that DOJ would give to, you know, the very, very top tier drug traffickers. And Ayman Juma became one of them. He was Lebanese. Ironically, he was Sunni, not Shia. And this goes back to where Murph, you were talking before about when there's money involved. You can put down all your wars. You can put down, you know, who hates who, if there's a buck to be made, right?
Yep, so, absolutely.
I remember during the Iraq War, one of the big things always talked about is as much as, you know, everybody hated it, still calls the Crusaders, the infidels. The Sunnis and the Shias hate each other more. And a lot of what was going on there was, you know, those two sides just trying to kill each other off.
Well, that was the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, that was, you got Iraq, which is majority Sunni, Iran, which is majority Shia. And it all deals with the belief in the 12th Imam, and, you know, and which the Shias believe in and the Sunnis don't. And believe it or not, that would be like the Baptists and the Methodists going to war.
certainly. Yeah. No, it's crazy. But we see plenty of instances in money laundering, especially, which leads you into the drug trade with the Lebanese, where the religious shields will be put down to conduct business. So you'd see Sunnis like Iman Juma dealing directly, partnering with Hezbollah. You'd see Lebanese Christians at times, you know, partnering, making deals, being part of organizations or networks conducting business.
And, you know, it doesn't extend there. When we talked, we were out at the Southern California Gang Conference. We were talking to some investigators there. When it comes to money, the Aryan Nations will work with anybody, with the Asian gangs, the black gangs, or whatever else. It's out on the street, they might kill each other, but inside the walls there, it's about commerce, man. It's about moving dope, moving money. And like you say, money, you know, politics makes strange bedfellows. Well, money and, you know, common goals make strange bedfellows too, especially when you've got religious implications.
Yeah, 100%. So they start making sense of these calls. And, you know, ironically, I think at the time, all they had, have some nicknames on the calls and maybe some of their own nicknames they were giving to associate with certain phone numbers being used. And literally at almost the exact same time, try to be a little careful here and keep it somewhat anonymized, but basically a drug trafficker that doesn't really want to be a drug trafficker, it's getting extorted at, is a business owner in Central America, walks into the U.S. Embassy, I think in Panama, and says, I need help. I'm being squeezed. I'm in the middle of this mess I don't want to be in. And guys of Middle Eastern origin, and he basically lays out the network that Miami Group 10's listening to. But he's got the real names. He's like, you know, they're calling somebody Flacco, like skinny guys. Like, well, Flacco is this guy and Gordo is this guy. And he basically lays out the network. And so they start to really uncover it and realize that they've got something going on. And through this guy's assistance, they're able to start an undercover money laundering operation. And seizing, I mean, Murph, you've seen the pictures on that trailer. I mean, some of the amounts of money, it's like a bed of money that an agent's sitting on for one picture. It's tens
crazy.
Of millions of dollars. At one point, these two knucklehead female Colombian money launderers are supposed to deliver, $5 million in Central America, and they actually accidentally deliver $20 million. They turn over the entire load of money they're sitting on. They weren't supposed to give that much, so we had to make it look like a real money laundering delivery that then gets hit, I think, in Spain by the Spanish. But basically money it's supposed to go over to the, I think ultimately to the Middle East.
Wow.
And they have to make it look like the money got taken off by foreign authorities. And so there's a way that we would do that where, you know, our guys that are actually moving it can prove that they got it to a certain point. Like, hey, you said here, we got it to the warehouse and the warehouse got hit. That's not on us. Somebody was watching your warehouse, right?
Yeah.
And so that's really when things started to unfold and a lot of the dots started getting lit up.
I like this scam you guys are running on these guys because it's like fishing, right? It's reusable bait. You take 20 million and you throw it out there, you seize the 20 million, you bring it back, and now you got 20 million to use again. You never lose any money. You just keep, you know, using it over and over. I like this. This has some potential.
Yeah.
It's not quite that easy, but
unfortunately, most major DEA scandals seem to revolve around these AGEOs as well. You know, they end up being the most well-placed, highest-level informants. Look, the really smart ones realize if I give up a drug load or two, I make a few bucks and I probably get my head lopped off. If I get into the money laundering networks, I get paid a hell of a lot better. Things go on. And, you know, a problem with some of these AGEOs is they take on a life of their own. No one wants to see it end. Some of the VIG, call it, you know, we're supposed to be money launderers, so there's a VIG built in that would go to the money launderer. And again, under very special guidelines, some of that can be used towards supporting operations. And it just becomes its own lifeblood that people don't want to see going away. So
we're going to have to start calling you. Go ahead, Murph.
I was just going to say the reporting requirements are monumental to do all this. So it's not as easy as Zach's making it sound here, but it is extremely productive.
Well, it's kind of like the British MI6, you know, 007 was a license to kill. We're going to start calling you 0012 license to launder. So, yeah.
Well, some of us feel like they were truly given one, you know, no names, but Carlos Urzeri down in Colombia. Like it's scandal in years and he's now up the river, right?
Yep.
Because guys just get a little blinded and end up on the wrong side of things.
And that's what we say here on Game of Crimes is nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
Yeah. Amen. Amen.
So he's where he belongs.
So you've got all this money, and here, just to put it in perspective, we're not talking about a cashier's check. We're talking about $20 million in cash, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, cold hard cash. That essentially, it's essentially Mexican cartel money. Like all this is going on in Central America, and so you have Colombian coke going up, ultimately the Mexican cartels being handed off in Central America, and the money's being handed off in Central America. And then in this instance, a lot of that has to be repatriated, some back down to Colombia, but a lot of it going overseas as well. And you had Lebanese and, you know, Hezbollah affiliated money laundering networks and drug trafficking networks that were conducting this. And there was drug shipments ultimately also going over to the Middle East as well. Part of what came out of this, at about the same time, we really started to uncover the Middle Eastern and especially Hezbollah connections in Venezuela. If you were to look at the cabinet in Venezuela over the last X number of years, you might think that you Googled the wrong thing and Googled a Middle Eastern country. Some of the names, you know, the former Venezuelan vice president, Tarek El Asami, very strong ties back over there. His family was part of the Ba'athist party, which was, you know, Saddam Hussein's party in Iraq, and very strong Hezbollah connections. Family members were Hezbollah affiliates. You really started to see Iran's influence in Venezuela. There was a famous flight, I think it was Convias Air, which was basically a direct flight going to Damascus every week from Venezuela with a couple hundred kilos on board of cocaine that was getting trafficked over there. You saw through the support of guys like Tarek, you saw Venezuelan passports being supplied to Iranian Revolutionary Guard and Hezbollah members, which gave them that's one of the most concerning parts of all. Now they had free rein to travel throughout, you know, Central America.
You just mentioned something. Let's tie in that because you mentioned something as we were getting ready to start this call, but there is somebody who is in a position of leadership now that was the oil minister and was dealing directly with Iran that a lot of people would recognize him as a pain in the ass right now and a world leader.
Well, I recognize him as indicted, but shout out to my old group who's holding the papers. But it sounds to me like you're referring to Nicolas Maduro, the current president of Venezuela.
And who would have thought Venezuela, an oil-rich country, is antagonistic towards the United States, would be involved in anything like this?
Well, I think more ironically, it all brings us back to our initial conversation on prisoner releases, because our fine administration was kind enough to release Maduro's stepsons, known as the Narco Sobrinos, last year after only serving a couple years of their sentence on a major operation my group ran in Central America. They were trying to move 600 or 700 kilos up to Central America. We caught them in a sting, captured them in Haiti, flew them here, and just decided to release them. So,
hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part 2.